Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to another edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. This is your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I'm excited for this episode. It's going to be a little bit different than normal in the sense of I usually moderate a panel and kind of stay out of the conversation as much, but this is going to be one in which I'll be a super full participant, and a lot of the questions and the things that will be talked about today will be coming at me. So let me tell you how this one came about. Two listeners to Mormon Matters wrote me, and they wrote me about 4 or 5 days apart, but they both kind of asked this similar thing, and it kind of began with, you know, hey, you know, I'm at church, I'm going through different things, and I'm being triggered by, you know, certain comments, or, you know, I know that there are things that are being taught have more complexity to them than what's being said here, and I don't know that if I want to participate and destroy anybody's illusions, but on the other hand, how can I be, you know, truly myself at church and things like that? And so they kind of came up with, you know, just like, what's it inside your brain? What's it like inside the brain of somebody who's decently at peace with Mormonism after having a long struggle of faith? And so we also decided to get a second person to be involved with this, who also seems to be at a peace of this sort. And so let me just tell you who's on the podcast. It's besides me doing a lot of talking on this one, Nyland McBain will be with us. Nyland just ended up publishing that book called Women at Church that came out about 3 or 4 weeks ago. And we're excited to have her as the second person to sort of be interviewed. And our two interviewers, the two fellows that wrote me, are Adam Levitt and Jefferson Burrell. And so let's just do some introducing of everybody right now. Nyland, can we have you talk about yourself a little bit first, and then we talk about the book in a minute?
Well, I was born and raised in New York City, right in Manhattan, near the Manhattan Temple. And I was the only child of a professional mother and mostly an active father. And I went to Yale for college in Connecticut, and then directly to San Francisco after college, where I worked in Silicon Valley in digital marketing for about 7 years. And after that, we went to Boston for my husband's graduate school, then back to New York. And then,
so you got married when you were in California? Or?
Just after college.
Okay, yep.
And and then we went back to New York, and then we moved to Salt Lake about 5 years ago.
Oh, what brought you out here?
Well, you know, it was just one of those times in life where you just realized that things need to change, and neither one of us had jobs or anything, but we did have family here, and so we just decided to go for it. So,
come to Zion, come to Zion.
Yeah, exactly.
Anyway, fun. Well, great to get to know you. So tell us about the book. It's called Women at Church, and then it, I can't remember what the subtitle is, but it's something about like about how to act locally and kind of how to, you know, be a, I don't know if you want to say a change agent, you know, on the local level, or what would you, how would you say it?
Well, the subtitle is Magnifying LDS Women's Local Impact.
Got it.
So the book has a couple of different purposes, but mainly the book is meant to be a conversation starter. So people are coming to the conversation about women at church from a lot of different directions now, especially after this summer with the Kate Kelly excommunication. There are a lot of feelings around it. And the purpose of the book is to, for those who may not understand where people like the Ordained Women group are coming from, it's an effort to explain some of the tensions that modern Mormon women are facing as they try to live joint lived experiences, both in the church and in sort of the day-to-day world. It's also an effort to try to encourage and present some ideas for problem solving to those who, you know, might not want to go as far as advocating for the ordination of women. The idea, the premise is that I believe that there's a lot that we can do, even with what we have now, to ease some of the tensions that I talk about in the first part of the book. And I try and present them in a very empowering way and say, hey, you know, we have the tools that we need on the local level to fix some of these problems ourselves, because they are problems of practice and tradition and culture. And they don't have to get in our way as much as they do now.
Right. Awesome. Yeah, I've heard nothing but good things, and I've heard you talk about it off and on the last month on various things, and encourage everybody to look into it. And I'm guessing that some of the framings and things that you talk about in that book will definitely come out as you frame a lot of the answers and stuff today. So let us know, and feel free to use tons of examples, you know, from the books, or say, this is also in chapter 3 or something too.
Okay.
You know, so we'll celebrate the book that way. So, well, great.
Thank you so much
for being on and being an interviewee with me on this.
My pleasure.
Our first interviewer, I think I'll just go in the order of who emailed me first. So, Adam, you were the first emailer, Adam Levitt. Tell us a little bit about yourself, where you live, and what your hopes are for this podcast and, you know, some of our early discussions.
Yeah, great. I live right now in the Twin Cities in Minnesota. I'm originally from the Boise, Idaho area. So I'm a convert to the church. I got baptized when I was 17. A little bit, about 2 years later, just under 2 years later, I went on a mission. I served in Haiti. So I was there from 2002 to 2004, and came home, got married about 3 months later, and I'm still married to my wife. We have two children. I've got a boy that's 8. And I've got a daughter that she's almost 2. So I'm definitely excited to have this conversation. I think even as we were framing, you know, how we kind of wanted to do this, I think maybe even putting some of my thoughts and ideas as to what I wanted to discuss really helped me understand kind of what my questions really were. So I think one of the reasons why I'm drawn to you, Dan, and I've listened to a lot of your podcasts on, you know, I listened to your Mormon Stories interview that John DeLynn did with you, and I've listened to you as part of a panel, and I've listened to a lot of the podcasts on Mormon Matters too, is the broad view of Mormonism, you know, how it's not maybe as restrictive as maybe I think, or maybe other members might present. And so I'm really drawn to that idea. And, you know, I've gone through probably a faith transition or a faith reconstruction, you know, maybe 9 years ago or so now, and off and on, I've been kind of waning in what I want to do and how I want to be, but I'm definitely drawn to the church. I feel like, I found, you know, I guess as a convert, I found my relationship with the Heavenly Father through Mormonism, and I can't help but feel that He's very accepting of that. I just want to try to be authentic in my viewpoint, but also be a Mormon. And so I think that's probably why I'm drawn to you. But I think at the end of a lot of the podcast, like, some of the questions are, well, how do you actually do that? How do you actually have this big broad view of Mormonism and still be a Mormon and not really dilute the church's teachings down so far that they're, you know, somewhat meaningless. So that's really what I'm hoping to discuss, and just to kind of pick your brain and Nyland's brain to see maybe how I could do it and how I could really be a full-blown Mormon but not be super traditional.
Awesome. Thanks so much. That's very helpful. Jefferson, introduce yourself a little bit. Jefferson Burrell.
Yes. So I'm Jefferson. Let's see. I live in the Central Valley in California. So sort of, I'm in Clovis, but most people don't know where that is. So it's in Fresno, right in the center there. I've been up and down the state. I served my mission in Kentucky. And about a year after I got back from my mission, I got married to my wife. We had some fertility issues, so we didn't really embark into the children thing until about 8 years after we were, after I was married. Now I've got two little boys, 7 and 5, and a daughter we just had a year ago. I think tomorrow is her birthday.
Neat.
So 1 year there. So the first time I, the first time you suggested this, that maybe I could be involved in this, I think I said, not me. I don't really have the credentials for something like this. So I'm still struggling with that idea that I have any business being on here. But since you've invited me, I'm going to do my best to try to represent all the other guys who feel like they have no business doing something like this.
Well, I mean, again, we need people who will just say, hey, all that highfalutin stuff with you, Mr. PhDs, and you know, that doesn't cut the mustard. So that, to me, that's the great credential, willingness to speak up.
Yeah, I suppose there's probably a fair number of highfalutin guys like me in the church who may be having similar struggles. Like Adam, it's probably been about 6 years ago that I sort of started coming across some or seriously investigating things that maybe all my life I'd wondered about, but thought, you know, finally, maybe I really am going to find out about this or that. And I think that's probably seems like when sort of the Mormon internet phenomenon really started, taking off. So there's began to be quite a lot of information to find there. And so I've been listening to, I think I've been listening to your podcast for 3 years now. And I've really, you know, even if I don't always, even if I sometimes I'm shouting at you during the podcast,
nice.
I've always very much appreciated that you have a kind of a wide view of how to frame your Mormonism. And, you know, I think Adam, from we had a conversation before this, he sounds like maybe he's kind of made a decision about how he feels about the church, and he's trying to now frame his involvement. I'm still kind of at a, okay, if I can't figure this out, I'm out of here, you know? So I'm maybe I'm not exactly like Adam as far as that goes, but I still feel like the church has a lot of benefits and benefits to my family. And I want to see, is there some way we can make this work? And, you know, how do I be authentic is really the main thing.
You might have just given us the title of the podcast, because in some ways I think that might be really what we're searching for here.
Yeah, because when Adam and I first talked, I think when you and I first talked, we thought, oh, let's go over, like, all the, you know, the hard details that people find out about. But I think we ultimately all settled on it. No, let's just talk about, like, how do we do, how do you become the authentic member when you also know about all of these harder issues? So, yeah.
Perfect. I think we decided ahead of time that you'd throw out the first question. So if you're ready to roll on that, please give it a go.
So I think both Adam and I have, were, you know, trying to be prepared for this. And, we spent some time listening to actually some of the, I spent some time listening to what I could find from, I seem to murder it. So, I spent some time finding anything I could about you, Nyland, just so that I could make sure I knew where you were coming from. And, you know, something from one of your podcasts that you did with Thoughtful Faith really kind of hit on one of the main things that I think both Adam and I were thinking about, which was you in your in that interview, you made a statement to the effect of that you're noticing that people and that some of the people you're coming across in the church who may be a little bit disenfranchised that are also like Adam and I trying to figure it out are asking themselves is what do you really have to believe in to consider yourself a Mormon? And, you know, sometimes, especially when I'm listening to these podcasts with Dan and I think, man, that is so awesome what he's saying, you know, like I can really get behind that. And then I pause for a moment and I'm like, but I'm not sure I could say that out loud at church and that everyone else would think I'm still a Mormon. And so maybe that question is kind of vague, but you also went on to say, you know, you think that people kind of need a, there's like a few things that people kind of need to believe in or have, you know, have some feelings about, which is the fall, the atonement, the resurrection and the restoration. And, you know, all of those things start to have different shades once you start learning about some of the more difficult issues with the church. And then when you start considering some of the way that the leadership has behaved recently, or the way that we might perceive the way they behave. And I just wonder, you've, I guess, Nylan, already said, you think that those are the things that someone has to settle on in order to call themselves a Mormon. But I don't know, Dan, do you agree with those? And what does that exactly mean when you say that you have settled, you have a testimony of those things? Because, for instance, the atonement, I feel like I would really like to believe in the atonement, and I think as far as a motivating factor, it has power. But I struggle with, like, how does it actually work? And I know that it's common to say, Joe, put that on your shelf, how it kind of works. But, you know, how do you deal with that? I mean, do you say out loud, hey, you know, I'd like to believe in this, but I don't know. What do you guys?
Yeah, I mean, Dan, I'd love to respond to some of that if you don't mind.
Well, yeah, I'd rather have you go, because you're going to give. I'm going to probably deconstruct it far more than these guys might be. I might be the first one that they yell out, like, that doesn't satisfy. But yeah, I want yours.
Well, I think your question is extremely deep, Jefferson, and it really gets to the heart of, I mean, it's got elements of our whole experience in it. The first thing that I noticed that you said is you kind of, as an aside, distinguish between what you might feel personally and then what you might feel is approved to, say, a church. And for me, that's a really important distinction because, you know, there really are sort of three different kinds, in my mind, of practice. There's the personal practice, which is how you act out what you personally believe. There's a community practice, which is, you know, when you go to church on Sunday, is it okay for you to say those things that you believe? And then there's this third kind, which is sort of the institutional practice. And I think we think that they necessarily have to bubble up to each other, right? The personal has to be approved by the community, and the community has to be approved by the institution. And I actually kind of think, in my mind, those are reversed. And I don't know why I think this. I bet I could, like, you know, analyze myself and figure it out. I think it has to do with something with, like, growing up in New York in the 80s and early 90s was kind of like growing up abroad today. It was kind of exotic and very far away from that institutional overlay, right? And really, my whole belief system was so much more shaped by my personal study and by the community than it ever was touched by the institution. And so I think for me, the latter is the personal is really the foundation, the pillar. And then that bubbles up and it can be supported by the community where I want, you know, where it's helpful. And then that can be supported by the institution where it's helpful. And you could say that that's, you know, that shows too much hubris, right? That it's sort of like following my personal religion. And of course, I don't mean it in that very literal sense, but I think perception wise, you know, there's this idea that what we believe in personally can't be okay if it's not something we can say at church. And I don't think I'd ever agree with that. There are certainly times that I don't say everything I'm thinking at church. But, you know, I also think that doesn't make it wrong that I believe those things. For instance, I just have a funny story that on Sunday, we had a lesson about being in the world and not of the world. And, you know, I probably disagree with half the things that were said there because, again, you know, I have a very strong sense of how I interact with the world. I grew up in New York City as a Mormon. Like, you have to really be able to, you know, negotiate those boundaries pretty young if that's your circumstance. And, you know, somebody said just last Sunday in this Relief Society class that, you know, girls who wear short skirts are walking pornography. And everybody came up to me afterwards, because and I raised my hand, and I wasn't going to say like that's baloney or you know that's a falsehood or whatever, but I was going to say something that I felt would sort of change the spirit of the discussion. But the lesson ended before I could make my comment.
Oh.
And I had probably no fewer than half a dozen people come up to me afterwards and say, What were you going to say? You know, because they knew that I was going to, they knew me well enough to know that I was going to be like, come on, let's change the spirit of what we're talking about here. And I think that one of the things that I really want to work towards in the church is this idea that we don't have to go to church every Sunday and agree with everything everybody is saying. You know, the gospel, as I think I said, I do believe, and your question is so complex, and I'm just starting to touch on it, but I do believe that there are, you know, faith, repentance, and enduring to the end, or some variation of that, is really what the Savior and what both in the New Testament and in the Doctrine and Covenants reiterates several times is really at the heart of the gospel. And so I think I go to that community and that institutional worship with that in mind, that you know, I believe in faith and repentance and enduring to the end, and I believe it in a way that doesn't have to mean that, you know, all of the nitty-gritty details that everybody tries to spell out in terms of practices and culture have to all be in agreement. I don't feel the need for that. I'm not diminishing the pressure that some people do feel when they say something contrary in church and feel ostracized for that. I know that that happens. But for me, for some reason, I'm just able to be that kind of person where people know I'm going to say that contrary thing, and they actually like that, and they look to me to do that. I have a lot more to my answer, but Dan, I mean, why don't you take a stab at it, and maybe we can go back and forth here a little.
You are totally where I would be on this terms of the personal versus what you're able to say at church and things like that, and just that sense. And, you know, if we take it out of church, you know, let's say that we're an expert in a field, a scholarly field or a technical field or something like that. You're not always called upon, you know, in every moment to share everything. Or when you're working with somebody who's, you know, doing algebra, you don't need to let them know that. But when you get to calculus, this is going to completely, you know, feel different to you or something like that. And so sometimes, you know, when you're at church, you're there to be together with each other. For me, I'm there far more as a gathering of people who are trying to live good lives, who are in service to each other. You know, I'm much more interested in the goodness of the people around me rather than, you know, the depth of their understanding. But of course, that took a long time for me to get to that point. And so, you know, I was just figuring it out. It was in 1989 when I first really started having these hard discussions. I luckily had Randy Paul, who's been on my podcast before, as a conversation partner. But it took me 10 or 12 years to kind of get to this place of peace. So I know where you guys are, even though it's 13, 14 years ago for me. I remember those times of like, don't you people get it? Can't you see it bigger than this?
Yeah.
And you know, and you're basing, or at least the way you're phrasing it, it seemed like you're basing your testimony on some historical claim that I know isn't factual. You know, it's based upon a mythic, you know, or, you know, somebody's, a legend that grew out, or, you know, or it's just completely wrong. And so it was very, very difficult for a long time. But then, you know, I've just got to the point of just a greater deal of comfort of just being, okay, everybody's got their expertise. Mine happens to be, you know, I've read, you know, 10 times more than you, you know, in this area. Uh-huh. I've been exposed to other religions. I've done these other things, but still on a Sunday together, I love our Mormon stories. I love at least the framings of the gospel. You know, I love the plan of salvation. Now, when we start getting into, we know every detail of what the celestial kingdom is like and, you know, and who's sealed to who and all, you know, all the minutia and all that stuff makes me crazy. But I'm always able to celebrate the gist of the story. And so I've talked about on this podcast before, you know, I'm not really I kind of have not, you know, I've just found life more powerful to not imagine a Satan character, a Lucifer character as the reason for sin. And yet I'll still happily tell the story of the council in heaven because of all the human truths, you know, the dynamics of, you know, want to be safe versus be adventurous and all those kinds of stuff. And I also shared on my podcast before, it was a moment, at least it had to be 8 years ago, maybe 12 years ago now, because it was during the Old Testament year in Sunday school, where I just finally realized that I don't have to be listening with both my scholarly ears and my church ears at the same time. You know, when I'm at church, I can have my church ears. There's this great story from Reed Nibley, who is a famous piano player, you know, famous pianist and, you know, Hugh Nibley's brother. And it's like, you know, somebody played a really bad, you know, musical number on the piano at church. And somebody went up to, "Oh, Brother Nibley, I bet that was painful for you to sit through this, you know, all these mistakes." And he goes, "Oh, I thought it was wonderful." And the person kind of pushed him a little bit longer. And he goes, "Well, you got to realize," he goes, "I have my church ears and I have my, you know, concert ears, or I have my, you know, when I'm teaching my piano student ears." And I kind of have gotten to that point within church too, where it's like, not always am I thinking outside the story to all the critiques of the story. I'm able to go with the story and kind of honor it for the truth that's at the core of it.
And I think what you're saying, honoring the truths that are at the core of it, I would say honoring the effects that it has on me and on the people that I love around me, and the effect that it has in creating that goodness that I admire in people. I mean, the world is made of stories. And, you know, I mean, any study that you look at that studies memory, I mean, we remember things with such variety, person to person. You know, over time, those memories change and the stories change, and we create these myths. And so in some ways, the world and the way the myths that we've built our civilizations on are lies. They're just falsehoods, except that, you know, and that's probably without exception, right? I mean, the stories of great business people and thinkers and politicians, and we tend to heroize people, if that's a word, you know, in ways that might not even be correct. And that happens extensively even outside the church. But I think, you know, what we do need to look at is the effect that those stories have on us. And we had this discussion in Gospel Doctrine just a couple weeks ago when we were studying Job. You know, we had a very lively discussion about whether this was a real story or not. And someone brought up the idea that this was a morality tale. This was a sort of, you know, written in a very poetic style, sort of, the way that a Greek tragedy would be written, in a very formulaic way. And other people said, "No, this really happened between God and Satan," and no one will really know, right? But the place we came to was, of course, concluding that the effect that the story has on us is a positive one, right? And it helps us, it gives us a framework, and it gives us tools for understanding why life is the way it is and how we can respond to it in ways that are most honoring of the best of human nature. And for me, I'm very much with Dan in that, you know, what effect these things have on me and the role that they play in my life is in many ways more important to me than whether, you know, Satan and God the Father actually had a conversation, or, you know, like, yeah. Like, and so, and it was, there was another story I'm recalling, which was very, you know, it really challenges this idea to the core. And I'm actually friends with one of the 12 apostles' daughters, and she was teaching a Relief Society lesson one time. And there was a woman who didn't know who she was, who made a comment about how she deeply admires the 12 for, for living off of their own means while serving in as the 12 apostles. And my friends tried to correct her, not revealing again who she was, but just said, actually, they receive a living stipend. And the woman said, oh, no, they don't. They are sacrificing all of their means to be of service to the Lord for the rest of their lives after they are called. And my friend, you know, was like, this woman was so passionate about this, like admiring these men for sacrificing so much on behalf of the church. She's like, what was I supposed to do? You know, when she knows that they all receive living stipends, she knows for a fact. And you know, she really struggled with that. And she said, I didn't, you know, was it a lie to just let this woman continue believing this? She has such deep admiration for this concept of sacrifice. And I don't know what the answer is, but for me personally, the idea that, you know, these truths make me a better person than I would be otherwise, that's undeniable for me.
Yeah, so if I could maybe interject, you know, and I think Jefferson and I both had this question specifically because I think this is kind of the crux of everything for me, I guess, is from what I'm hearing, you know, both of you saying, and it's very similar to the other podcast of this, that Dan, that you've put on about this broad view of, you know, this institutional level, you know, maybe I go to work in a professional environment and I'm not going to, you know, lay my whole life out for my coworkers and for other people, you know, and I do have to, you know, play the game a little bit, you know, within an institution of, you know, the church, my ward, you know, my Sunday meetings or whatever. For me, you know, and then, you know, along that line, I can have my own personal, you know, faith, my own personal level of belief within, you know, what I do at home or what I do personally. And those don't necessarily have to intersect at church when I'm at the pulpit, maybe bearing my testimony. I don't have to, you know, get up and say, you know, I know all of these things. For me, I guess, you know, as someone who, you know, I don't know what I believe, I don't know what I accept, it's, how does utilizing or performing priesthood, you know, me as a Melchizedek priesthood holder, you know, that is where the intersect happens, where you say, I'm going to perform an ordinance. Maybe I'm going to, you know, be involved in setting somebody apart or giving a blessing. You maybe do the communal things that we do at church that involve utilizing the priesthood, you know, and to me, I say I can have my own personal view of, you know, the restoration of the priesthood. And maybe I don't know if I believe exactly how the story went down, but that specifically entails so much to say I believe that Joseph Smith received the keys of, you know, through Peter, James, and John, and through John the Baptist, and the whole stories that were heard at church, and that kind of engulfs the whole entire restoration and everything. And I'm actually outwardly in front of everybody, regardless of how I feel about that personally, I'm laying my hands on somebody's head. Or, you know, I baptized my son this spring. I'm baptizing my son, and I like to perform that communal ritual to outwardly say that my son is also, you know, I wanted to be a part of that, and he wanted me to be a part of that, to say, you know, we are going to, you know, we're members of the church, you know, he's on the path, and we're doing that. But you know, from what we are taught from in young men's, and I wasn't in young men's for more than really a year and a half, I don't see how you can maybe personally have a view of, I don't know if I really believe the restoration of the priesthood, but I can go to church and live the, you know, what I say in Dan Weatherspoon, or Dan, you said, excuse me, the myth within the church and hear the stories and live the stories, but I actually have to lay my hands on somebody's head, or I actually have to perform that ordinance. I don't know how you fit this in with what you're saying, I guess, Dan.
If I can jump in and add something to what to Adam's question, because sure. It's very similar. You know, I actually, you know, so my daughter is now, I mentioned at the beginning, my daughter's now a year old, and, you know, it came time to the do that baby blessing. And now doing the baby blessing was very, you know, I had a little bit of a struggle because I was thinking, you know, I'm not sure I feel about the priesthood like I used to feel about it, but I do know I feel about my daughter. You know, I know how I feel about my daughter. I know that if I was, you know, if I'm a part of this community, and I get to stand up right and say all the good things I want to say about my daughter, just like every other guy who's had their chance to do this,
right.
And they gave the blessing. Because, you know, a baby blessing is not quite the same as a baptism. It's not an ordinance.
It's not considered an essential saving ordinance.
An essential saving ordinance. But, you know, when I stood up there, I do know that everyone is looking, and they're assuming I feel the same way about the priesthood while doing it as they feel about the priesthood. And you know, that was really the problem I was having, not saying the words or saying or, you know, doing the action or whatever. It was, I don't know that I want all these people believing that I believe the same as them. Now, I also don't know that that I have a right to tell them all, you know, I don't believe the same as you. But, you know, with my oldest son coming up to, I'm kind of getting to out of this position where I'm like, ooh, what am I going to do in a year from now when my family is going to expect that I'm going to baptize my son, when I'm kind of like, ooh, do I start him down this road where he may possibly bump into all these problems, or do I explain to him, oh, well, you're doing this because of these things. They may be not the right same reason why everyone else is doing it. I'm not sure if I've really piggybacked onto it, but you see where that's like becomes
all of it
a complication?
For sure.
Just wonder, do you give blessings, Dan?
Yes, absolutely.
And
recently even, yeah.
And when you give blessings, do the people generally getting blessings from you, do they generally kind of know where you're coming from?
No. Well, but again, where am I coming from? It kind of quit being a divided South a while ago. So you're assuming, you know, that this is like an active trauma for me at this moment. It was definitely years ago, but. And you guys, you know, it's like here's the dilemma. A lot of the listeners of Mormon Matters have probably heard certain stories again. Do I tell them again, or do I assume that you've heard them? In some ways, I have to tell some again. And this, I'll just tell a very brief version of, you know, being denied the right to actually ordain my son when he turned 12 to the priesthood. And because there's some things in there that I think we can jump off of. So quickly, what had happened is about 6 months before my son turned 12, we had just moved into a new ward. And, you know, after a few months there, the bishop came over to offer me a calling. But it was also right on the heels of my wife having coming home from talking to the bishop. And I don't know how they got chatting, but she had mentioned that, you know, my husband, Dan, you know, struggles with lots of things in Mormonism. You know, we're active and we're trying things, but he's really, you know, struggling. And so when the bishop came over to ask me, you know, to do this calling, I said, sure. But I go, I'm kind of surprised you're offering me this calling given what Lori said to you, you know. And he goes, what do you mean? And, well, you know, I'm struggling with this and that and the other thing. And he goes, oh, really? I don't remember any details. Tell me some details. And I was just like such a, you know, one of those modes where I wasn't grown up enough to just kind of like try to frame things positively. It was like I just laid out problem, you know, kind of thing. And it was just like not a skillful presentation of where I was. And so, you know, for a half hour, this bishop's listening to me with all my struggles, and you can kind of see the jaw dropping, and he's, you know, what's going on? And so he goes, well, you know, I better rethink this calling. I'll go home and pray, and, you know, let me withdraw, you know, asking you right now, and I'll get back to you. And then he never really did. But then, you know, a few months later come along, and my son is about to turn 12. And when he, you know, started talking to us about having him do it, and he says, well, who would you like to ordain him? And I said, I would. And he like looks at me like, after all the things that you just told me, boom, boom, boom. And so I ended up writing him a long letter about all the different reasons that I wanted to ordain him and whatnot. And I kind of fully expected the day of it that he would let me do that. But he called that morning and says, I don't feel like, unless you've fundamentally changed and you have a burning testimony that Jesus is the Christ, that the atonement, you know, is the way that we're saved from our sins. And I can't remember how he phrased it. He goes, I just don't feel good about letting you bless your son or ordain your son. And I'm like, dude, you know, this is the wrong decision, you know, kind of thing. But we went to church that day and the ordinance took place, and our son had this huge personality, and he had invited half the guys in the ward that he, you know, my son's rebellion, I'll let you guys know, it's kind of funny. He's like this kid that came out of the womb wanting to shoot bows and arrows and guns and things like that, and I'm like a total not hunter, not fisher, none of these guys. So his rebellion was wanting to be an outdoorsman, and so he had kind of picked up all the outdoorsy guys in the ward as sort of in his posse, all these adult men. So there's like 7 or 8 guys in there in the circle, and I'm excluded from the circle from ordaining my conferring the priesthood upon my son and all that stuff. And so they do the ordinance, and the moment, you know, came afterwards where I just stood up. I didn't know what I was going to say ahead of time, but I just stood up and I just wanted to thank, I thanked everybody for being there. I said, you know, you're all good guys. You're all wonderful people in your life. I want you to know that I absolutely wanted to ordain my son today. There's nothing amiss in my life, you know, that prevents me in terms of worthiness from not doing it. I disagree with the bishop's decision on this, but, you know, my relationship with the gospel and God right now are a bit more complicated, that he didn't feel like this was the time to go, but I want Alex to know that I love him, and I want you all to know that I appreciate the role that you're playing in his life. And it turned out to be a very nice, you know, moment, you know, kind of thing. But at play there was, I guess, this issue that you guys are talking about.
That's an intense story, Dan.
You make it sound, this is the wonderful thing about you, right? It comes out sounding so nice out of your mouth. And I, on the other hand, like, man, I'm angry about just hearing that happen to him. And it brings that a frustration I constantly share with some of my other disaffected friends, which is that I feel like, right, a beautiful part about Mormonism is the community, but the other part about unfortunately that same beautiful part about Mormonism has, when you turn it over, has this unfortunate fact where it feels like, to some degree, I'm not in charge of my faith, I'm not in charge of my relationship to the ordinances and those kinds of things, right? I can't say,
right.
It's not like it'd be one thing if I registered with the bishop, like, I'm going to baptize my son and I can fill about the baptism however I want. Instead, I'm asking permission. And I know, right, a lot of other religions don't quite, you know, some of them don't quite have those that kind of community nature to them. So this problem really never bumps into, you never bump into these problems, right? Because it's going to be the priest that does the baptism, right? It's never going to be the father anyway. So the father never has to demonstrate his worthiness. Now, these are all kind of, some of these things are beautiful, right? It's kind of beautiful that we're all kind of held, we're all priests. We're all trying to, right? We don't have, our leaders aren't, we don't have this distance from them and some, well, depending on which leaders you're talking about, but we don't have this distance, right? My bishop is just a guy in charge in a way, right? But he's not necessarily expected to be better than me. But then there's though this unfortunate other fact, which is that he though also can control my participation in the faith, you know, and it just, that's where this is, would be one of those moments when I would rile, where I'd be shouting at the podcast, and I guess I am now shouting at the podcast.
I think it's totally understandable. I mean, that is a very difficult situation, and it really does highlight all of the, you know, potholes that we experience in our do-it-yourself church. You know, where we're working together. It's like, you know, it's like getting passed over for a promotion at work, but like so much worse, right? You feel like you've done everything you can, and like it's in somebody else's hands, and you're just like, you know, what more can I do? And you know, those situations grate on you in like regular life circumstances, but when your whole, you know, soul is at stake, it's just it's really grueling. I mean, one of the things that helps me is, as you said, you know, and you're identifying the beautiful elements of our practices, but really to dwell on those in a very real way. And one of the ways I do that, One of the ways I did that recently was actually by attending a Baptist congregation here in Salt Lake. And it was interesting because this was a very sort of charismatic Baptist group, and we took our three kids with us, and we were explaining to them in the car on the way over the idea of baptism by immersion being a kind of rare in other Christian denominations. And when we walked into this service, they were actually performing baptisms right there in the chapel sanctuary area. And, you know, there was a lot of singing going on, and it was really loud, and lots of microphones and AV, and these people were getting in the water. They did about five of them, I think, at the time. And I asked my girls after we got home that afternoon, I said, how were they baptizing those people? What were they saying? And my oldest said, they said, by the power of your faith, we baptize you. And we talked about that a little bit, because one of the things that I really struggle with is this idea of, in terms of blessings, priesthood blessings, what is a priesthood blessing, how does a priesthood blessing compare with the kinds of blessings that our foremothers used to give through the power of faith? So what more do you get, right, when you get a blessing through the Melchizedek priesthood as opposed to a healing blessing through faith? That's a question. That's an open question that I have. I wonder, if I laid my hands on my daughter's head, would something, significantly different happen than if my husband laid his hands on her head? But one thing I don't necessarily struggle with, is this idea that there is some authority in baptism and in saving ordinances, that really is not present in other places where they're not only blessing by faith, but they're actually doing, what they consider to be saving ordinances by faith. And for me, going to a Baptist church and seeing that, it was beautiful. And don't get me wrong, I mean, I love the singing, and I wish we had a lot more charismatic elements. But it wasn't through the authority of the priesthood. And I felt that. And I don't know how else to describe it, but it didn't have some of those same beautiful elements that we're talking about our own practices have, as with all of their faults.
See, in the, I guess, I think, I hear this and I think it sounds great. I mean, it sounds that we can have the faith and we can, we can do our, essentially, like you're saying, Nyland, to say that I'm going to bless my daughter, what's the difference between the priesthood, and not. And I think either having the priesthood and performing a blessing or praying over my child, what really is the difference? And I guess when I look at those types of things from my standpoint, and I think it's probably selfish of me, I say, well, I want to be in Mormonism. And as a man in Mormonism, I have to be ready for those types of things. I need to actually perform a priesthood ordinance. Maybe it's just a child, blessing a sick child or something, but on the levels of maybe a baptism, and you hear a story like Dan's other people that have maybe a similar story, I guess I kind of live in fear of that a little bit. But at the same time, I feel like, well, if I told even a general authority, if I told one of the 12 that, I choose to believe in God and I feel something there, but that's really all I can say I believe. I don't really buy the whole historicity of the restoration of the priesthood exactly how it was presented. Would that person, no matter how sincere, no matter how nice I was, no matter how worthy I was, would they allow me to participate in that, in performing that priesthood ordinance? And so I either have to make the choice if I'm going to be kind of secretive and not really tell them how I really feel, or my bishop or my stake president, or I'm going to have to just come out. And I feel like I need to just come out and be honest, because I want to be authentic and say, hey, I want to do these things because I love Mormonism and I think I feel something there from God, but I really don't, I really don't believe this stuff. So I don't know. That's where the personal comes in with the institutional, I guess.
I, for a little comic relief, I will tell you what my dad did, and it was decline promotion. he was an Aaronic priesthood holder his whole life, and he had a number of bishops who tried to promote him, and he just kept saying, no, thank you, I declined the promotion. And I don't know, he was very upfront about exactly what you said, but he also was a convert and didn't feel like he had a lot of sort of, you know, familial pressure on him. But, he participated at will as he wanted, pretty much his whole life. And people just knew, you know, he was, John McBain was an Aaronic priesthood holder. And if he wanted him to pass the sacrament, that was great, but don't ask him to, you know, confirm anybody.
Right.
See, but doesn't that leave you on the fringes kind of Mormonism? I mean, I guess as a Melchizedek priesthood holder, you know, I'm going to be the guy.
It does. It does. Absolutely. Yeah, it does. Again, it's a sort of comic story, but because he didn't really care. Right. But I think I always took his self-awareness for granted. I think I've appreciated that more as I get older, that he actually was able to say, look, you know, I love this community. I'm really happy to be a part of it. I believe in God, but I don't know that I could practice these particular rituals with that kind of integrity.
Well, and Adam, you were kind of, there's lots of layers in this particular subject that we're dealing in here. And Adam, you added back the layer of just the arbitrariness. And when you said, if you were to share all that with your bishop, would he still let you do it or not? And I would guess that most would, but some certainly wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And so that was the case where I had a bishop. But luckily, my bishop was not doing out of the sound of kind of any kind of arrogance or any kind of, I'll teach this guy a lesson to fly right. You know, he was just a humble guy who I think I scared to death with, you know, bringing up so many issues with him just a few months earlier. But the one that really bothered him was that I really hadn't, you know, found my way to really affirm the atonement. And so that's the one that stuck with him. I'll tell you, my wife was having the reaction more that you guys described. She was the one that was going ape over me not being able to do it. And it was partly because she had just finished a stint in primary presidency, where a lot of times when these kids turn 8 and they're from inactive families, they'll basically pull the father out of the bar the night before, you know, and he's got priesthood, and we'll dust off that priesthood and we'll have him do the ordinance for his son, you know, just as a way to try to reactivate this guy. And here she was looking at me as this guy that was, you know, so intensely in these questions. You know, this is, you know, I'd been battling 7 or 8 years to kind of keep my, you know, my faith alive and my desire to participate with Mormonism going, and they were the ones telling me no. So she was a lot more mad than you, but I was glad I didn't have to deal with kind of an arrogant bishop. It was just a bishop who, you know, humbly chose that.
It points to a lack of consistency, which can be grating for a lot of people, right? Because as you say, somebody else could have had a completely different experience, and it could have, you know, they could have put you in the circle right there, and it could have been that turning moment for you where you realized how important it is for you to be a part of this. And instead, you know, it was the personality of the bishop, the age of the bishop, whatever it was, dictated a different response. What if I could just say one thing about my book, Women at Church? One of the things that I would love the book to have, one of the effects I would love for it to have, is a more consistent response to situations, maybe not like specifically the one you described, but to situations where, you know, where questions of women's involvement are raised. Because right now there's a wide range of responses among both male and female leadership in the local level. And one of the things I hope that it will do is even out some of those responses, so that, you know, people in Boston and LA aren't telling me that, you know, they're holding their babies in their blessings, whereas some people in other parts of the country are being chastised for even suggesting it. So, consistency.
Just as a disclaimer, I really like my bishop. He's really a cool guy.
Disclaimer here too. I like my bishop as well. Yes, and never. So you hear these stories about the roulette of your ecclesiastical leaders, and I so far have not bumped into that. But it does, though. You know, there is this very, like I said, sometimes beautiful, but oftentimes tragic nature of the way that the Mormon church is such a community or whatever. You know, when it works for you, it really works for you. But when it doesn't work for you, it can be painful.
Yeah.
So. But yeah, same thing happens at work. Same things happen in social club. You know, there's lots of places where, you know, you get somebody in a leadership role who makes the wrong decision and it affects you. And
totally.
we can't just totally, abandon all hope.
If I can push back just a little bit, though, Dan, you know, those institutions don't claim any divine mantle, any divine, you know, guidance.
Yeah.
Whereas this one does. And that's where...
We hope it would be better, right? We hope it would be different.
Yeah, or maybe it hurts more. And, you know, when you're dealing with that and you're dealing with the fact that you're like, you know, like with my bishop, for instance, since we're talking about bishops, and I don't want to stray too far from the subject, but my bishop has been very, he called me in for an interview because he wanted to extend a position to me that I had no idea required a temple recommend. It was a clerk or something like that. And I was, you know, I had to tell him, well, you know, he's like, we just need to get your temple recommend real fast. I noticed you didn't have one. So I was like, okay, I don't think I can answer the question. He said, well, let me ask him. So we go through it. And turns out he was like, yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. Which I was somewhat offended because I thought, I'm not going to rob the church because I can't answer the temple recommend questions. But since then, you know, we've had lots of conversations, and he's totally willing to deal with me as, you know, you're a part of our community, and I'll always invite you into our community. But, you know, I know he's not willing to hear the difficult history of the church or those kinds of things. And so when you're dealing with someone who has this right to sort of judge your ability to participate in an ordinance for your child, and yet doesn't necessarily know what you know, you're kind of like, hey, you're not giving me a fair shake here, you know? If you're not even necessarily giving the church a fair shake. It's kind of a challenge. But
the fact that you can say that out loud to him, I think, is the key.
Well, I can say that out loud in a lunch meeting we've taken to not meeting at church because I think he feels like, but I can't, right? I couldn't say that out loud in church. And, you know, it's probably not right for me to call him on the mat in church, but it's a challenge.
And just to add to that, I know we've delved in on this quite a bit. It seems well and good that we say, you know, we can have our own personal level and I really, this resonates with me really well. If Dan Weatherspoon was my bishop and Nyland was my stake president, I think I'd be great.
I'd be in great shape.
Yeah, that would be really awesome. Can I just say
but,
that right now?
I'd be presiding here.
Yeah, but
nice.
If that's how it was, but there is a rigidity all the way to the top. I mean, the recommend questions are, you know, I know they're purposely left open so that you can kind of interpret them, but that's not necessarily, you know, and maybe this is just me, but I don't think so. It feels like from the tone at the top, it is you need to have a testimony, which is a personal witness or a personal, some type of personal manifestation of these things. And if you don't, I can't really answer the temple recommend questions, which means no matter what I do, I'm not really worthy to enter into the temple, which means I'm kind of outside of Mormon. I'm on the outside looking in. So I guess the rigidity is where I feel it, and I feel like the church is there, and I think maybe they have to have that, but I don't know how we respond to that with this, both you and both Nyland and Dan, what you're presenting just doesn't seem like it really works within the church.
You said a couple times, like, you wish you could, your hope, what your book does is write, kind of make some consistency throughout the church with the way they deal with women and such. Sometimes I'm like, yeah, we need that, you know, sort of top-down-ish statement about these things. But other times I'm like, and I think this can go along with what you're going to say, which is that I feel like actually it's the flexibility of each congregation, which is sometimes the strength of the church or whatever, you know. But then we don't want to go but what would the church be if we went so far as to have, you know, there's only so much flexibility you can have and still all call each other.
Right.
Latter-day Saints. But go on, sorry.
Oh, no, I mean, you're right. I mean, I think what I am suggesting in terms of the way we interact with women is kind of, it's drawing a different line than saying, you know, we need the people who are in our temples and performing our ordinances to have a certain cache of faith to draw on as they're doing those things, right? So I am absolutely advocating for more flexibility in the local level and practices and sort of cultural traditions. But I mean, you're right in that I think, you know, the recommend and the you know, performing ordinances is probably a different, it's a different criteria. But I think, you know, back to the question about the temple recommend interview, I wonder, obviously I've never been in the situation of asking temple recommend questions, but I wonder what would happen. And I'm sorry, I kind of got lost track of who was asking that. Was it you, Jefferson, who was describing being in the temple recommend interview with your bishop?
I think we both actually did. So,
I wonder, you know, I mean, and maybe this is what you said. If you said, you know, to a response to one of the questions, you know, I have a sincere desire that that is true, that it, a sincere hope that, that is true. And I am, you know, I'm working towards developing a greater assurance of that. But right now, it's like in Alma 32 where I just have a desire to believe on that. You know, I just have a hope in the word. And this is what I'm doing to sort of, you know, shore up the conviction and to grow that seed. I mean, is that the kind of conversation? And I just wonder what a bishop would say to that, because, I mean, it's hard. One of these paradoxes we have is that that I think does us a great disservice is that we think we're supposed to go around saying we know everything is true, and yet, you know, Joseph Smith said that one of the great qualities of the gospel is that we're continuously seeking for truth, and that, you know, if we knew how much we didn't know, we would be shocked that we're just at the very bottom of a ladder of eternal learning. And so, you know, one of the things I think it does us a disservice is this idea that we're supposed to know everything. Because in reality, it's all going to be a journey. It's all just a desire, right? It's all just a desire now that through our lives is hopefully growing into a seed. But I wonder if that kind of language were used, what a bishop's reaction would be.
See, and I think, go ahead, Dan.
I was just saying, I think positive, but most of them. But again, go ahead.
See, and I feel like I can frame, you know, my viewpoint currently on the church, which, you know, again, I'm drawn to Mormonism. I, you know, I feel something here. That's kind of where I'm at. And I could frame that into whatever way would be pleasing to whoever heard it. I could say, you know, do I have a testimony of Heavenly Father? And I could say, you know, I feel something. Do I have a testimony of the Savior? And I could say, you know, I'm comfortable with that. Or I could on the flip side say, gosh, I don't know what I believe. I don't. The restoration, that doesn't make sense to me, really. There's a lot of things that aren't, you know, I could, in the same interview with the same mindset, say words that make me go one way or say words out of my mouth that make me go the other way, I'm trying to ride that line of authenticity.
I guess I'm wondering, what are you comparing it to? Like, you know, to know something or to feel something or to desire something is something really only you can know, right? And I think what I'm saying is unfortunate is that you might be comparing yourself to somebody who's standing up there at testimony meeting saying, I know the church is true, when in reality what they're responding to is just that very same feeling that you're having, but they're just framing it in a different way. So,
right.
You know, so saying that I feel something may be good enough for someone else, right, to bear witness and to bear testimony, whereas for you, you're approaching it from a less direct comparison to pure knowledge, and you're saying, wow, this is really just a hope or a desire or a little seed. And I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think for me, I, you know, the Alma 32, I have created a space to have a desire to believe, and I guess that's kind of where I'm at, and I can present myself in that way, and I think it can be authentic, but I could also take the
Dan Weatherspoon approach and say, well, here's all my problems, and then I can't ordain my son to the priesthood. You know, so it's just one or the other ways to present that, I guess.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with being skillful if you have an end desire. And, you know, if you feel like you're not going into it in order to be deceptive or in order to pull a fast one or something like that, you know. So for me, I wanted to have, I think it was Jefferson who was talking about, or, you know, blessing his baby. You know, I wanted to have that intimate experience with my son to say to him, you know, the things that I loved about him the most, and to celebrate his goodness and all the qualities that I saw in him and that I, you know, hoped that this priesthood, you know, advancement would be an enhancement of. And I wanted it for all those different reasons. The fact that I wasn't sure if the priesthood is anything more than Dumbo's feather, by which, you know, it's the ordinance that some hands are put upon my head that make me think I have the right to fly, you know, Dumbo's case, or the right to, you know, let go of my own brain for a second and see what spirit might, you know, say through my mouth, or, you know, but I might be a conduit from somehow, you know, I was in the question of Dumbo's feather or something real power that was communicated there, but I had zero desire to be deceptive to the church. And so the issue that kind of came up in the early framing of this question of, like, if I were ordaining my son and I was in the circle with all those great guys that were there, would I have felt inauthentic with them not, you know, knowing that I have all these questions? Heck no. This thing was about Alex. It was about a moment in his life. I wanted him in the church. I wanted him to have those chances to serve other people and to, you know, there's some formal things that kind of happen, that this part of the reason that I'm so desirous for women to have the priesthood too, because there's just these things that happen inside you that say, guess what? You're a man of God. You're a daughter of God. You're a divine being, and you get to handle the powers of heaven. And you start out these are the baby steps. These are the first steps. These are the things to where you learn to work with the spirit and stuff like that. So I wanted all those things in his life, even though, you know, is this the only priesthood? Is this the only way to be saved is through these ordinances? I was in the question then about that. And I'm in the question about it now. I just gave a pretty long answer there, but I there's one other little piece I want to do before we, you know, I don't know how close we are to ending this segment of it, but I do want to say one more thing. I think it was Adam, when you kind of talked about, you know, they prepare these temple recommend questions, you know, right from the top, and their expectation is that those who are going to the temple have had some kind of spiritual witness and some kind of testimony about these various things that they're doing, and that that's the expectation. And when you phrased it, at least you, how you did, and I may have, you know, not done a good job of summarizing it, that I just right at that moment I wanted to jump in and say, man, I don't think that's their expectation at all. I have a feeling that they know that this is aspirational rather than factual. I have a feeling that the main thing that they're concerned about is, does this person kind of, are they taking seriously the gospel enough to where they desire to go and make new covenants? You know, or to renew covenants, or, you know, to do those kinds of things. I really think that that's what it's about, because I think they know that every person is on a different journey and everyone has a different level of it. You know, I haven't been a bishop or stake president. In some ways, I informally serve that role a little bit through all the people that write me and talk to me and stuff like that. Or just the fact that I speak up the way I do in church often. I get, like you do, Nyland, people coming up to me afterwards and kind of confessing their stuff here.
Yeah.
I know, and I got to think that those leaders all know that this idea that, you know, you're representing something by performing an ordinance, they know the diversity of the belief levels among the people in the ward. Just like everybody I've talked to is far more interesting than I ever gave them credit for before I talked to them, you know what I mean? And so when I end up talking with somebody, they always surprise me with the level of thoughtfulness, as well as the humility by which, you know, I'm not so sure about that, or, you know, honestly, when it comes to the atonement, I've had so many people say, I just don't get this Jesus thing, you know? And yet everyone's there, you know, in the name of Jesus Christ, doing all these things in ordinance, and we're talk of Christ, and we do all that stuff. And there's so many people that just aren't there about the atonement. So I just wanted to kind of say that I have a feeling that, you know, we're putting more on what the brethren are thinking as they write the temple recommend questions and kind of what the expectation is of the belief level. I think they're perfectly happy with people being on a journey.
And I'll share, I mean, I'm not quite sure what the purpose is, but I'll share an experience we just had this week in my own home. So the Ogden Temple dedication is coming up, and children over the age of 8 have to have the special yellow ticket to attend. So I have a 10-year-old daughter and an 8-year-old daughter. So they both went in last Sunday to speak with our first counselor. And my oldest daughter is, you know, she's going to be on a podcast one day asking all these questions.
Nice.
And that evening, she came to me and my husband, and she was in tears. And she said, you know, Mommy and Daddy, he asked me today if I have a testimony. And I said, yes. And she was crying. And she said, I don't know if I told the truth. And I said, now, so are you upset because you feel like you didn't tell the truth? Or are you upset because you don't feel that you have a testimony? And she said both. And, you know, I don't know where that point is supposed to be, where like it's okay for a 10-year-old to come and say, I'm not sure I have a testimony, but it's not okay for like a 32 or a 37 or a 47-year-old to go in, you know, to come and just to speak confidentially and intimately and say, I'm not sure if I answered that question correctly. But basically what my husband and I did was say exactly what Dan just said. Do you want to be at this temple dedication? Will you be there with a pure heart? Will you be there to seek, you know, more experiences that will help you develop that testimony that you want? We read Alma 32 together, you know, and we had kind of the same conversation on a very elementary level with her. And I hope, you know, she went to bed that night feeling like my answer was honest to myself, you know, because I have that purity of heart that Dan was just talking about. And I was really grateful that she came to us and wanted to talk to us about that. And I hope that it just laid the foundation for her to be able to be really honest with herself and with others in the future.
That's a cool story. Thank you for sharing that. Jefferson and Adam, you both, you know, kind of asked lots of layers to this sort of you know, being in public, manifesting, you know, something that might not totally match the insight. Is there anything left in that one before we move on to something else? Or, you know, and again, this is your chance to say, this still doesn't work, you know, or whatever you want to say.
Yeah, I'm not sure. There's lots of beautiful things being said here. I think with some of this, it'll be this evening when I'm just like, ah!
Yeah.
You know, I don't know about that one or that. But this does seem like a good chance to move on to one of my other questions. And I know we originally sort of talked about Adam and I going back and forth, but I think it goes kind of along with this, because one of the other things that at least comes up for me is that, you know, even if I'm saying, I feel this way about the community, I feel like I want to participate in this thing for maybe the chance to know that it's true or whatever, but what I feel like I sometimes have a problem with, and this kind of comes up to, you know, some of the things that happened this last summer with the church, but, and sort of actually the beginning of my, I didn't really mention this at the beginning, but when I decided that I'm going to really like investigate all these things that I had concerns with, really started for me right after Prop 8. Of felt like I was asked to do, I did what I was told to do, you know, what I felt like I was being told to do. You know, I went in and I voted for Prop 8, and then I left feeling terrible. And so then I thought, you know, if I could feel terrible about this thing that I've just told to do, maybe all these other questions I've always had have validity as a question. And so since then, my problem, really, one of the problems I seem to have is that you know, where is my responsibility to say, you know, I may believe in all of these things, but hey, you know, I think the church has got this wrong. And, you know, how do I politely say, you know, this is wrong. I'm sorry. You know, the church may be right on this, but this is absolutely wrong. I feel sometimes like, you know, where do my personal morals, you know, am I allowed to have separate morals from the church, if that makes any sense? You know, how do we discuss those kind of things? You know, is my participation in the church, my support of the church, especially say by way of tithing, how much of that is just giving cover for the church to do things that I also don't agree with? You know, I feel
now that's a separate question than the earlier one.
Well,
I know what you mean. It gets asked a lot, so
it's more stinging. That's for sure. And I kind of feel like, you know, here in California, maybe in Salt Lake, there's been a lot more discussion about Kate Kelly, but there hasn't been as much here. But the few times I've come across it, the responses to what happened are not, I don't feel, represent the most Christ-like take on it. And I sometimes feel at the very least I need to say, hey, let's back up a little bit. But then I feel like on top of that, hey, you know what? Maybe I'm not quite being honest when I don't say, and I also don't agree, you know? You know, I don't know. How does that?
But you know what? I think that there's a difference between authenticity and being honest and being wise and smart about the best way to communicate with your audience. And that's what I spend a lot of time in Women at Church, my book, talking about, is, you know, meeting an audience where they are. And if you want to give these people a copy of my book, you are more than welcome. But you know, you don't need to lay out all your cards on the table if that audience isn't receptive to it. That's just something that I firmly believe in as a communication principle. And I don't think that that means that you're being inauthentic. I think that that means that you're being sensitive to the situation and smart about, you know, meeting the needs of the people that you're talking with. I think, you know, if you feel clear about where you stand on a position like what happened to Kate Kelly, then, you know, your responsibility is to, I think, present that in a way that, you know, creates a bridge with those people that you're talking about. And I don't know, I think if you've done that, then I think you've done a tremendous service to both them and to you.
You know, if I can tack on to that, again, another tacking on to Jefferson's question is with the children, you know, I guess along the lines of, hey, I want to teach my children to follow the prophet and to follow our leaders, but not on that issue. But, you know, I don't really want to have my child have this viewpoint that's kind of presented in primary or something on that, that one issue. How do you ride that line?
Well, for kids, I certainly don't think they need to have a very complicated view of it. That's something that naturally, as they become curious as teenagers and into young adulthood, that's where you have the discussion with the nuance. I tend to not be that particularly triggered by, you know, I don't necessarily love follow the prophet. I don't love the marching tune that song is, you know, kind of played to with that cadence that makes it even, you know, follow the prophet, you know, all that kind of stuff, you know. But on the other hand, you know, a time and a place, questions naturally come up. As long as you've communicated all along to your children that you're open to any question, there's nothing that they could throw at you that you would reject them over or think that they're a bad person. I think it's healthy that they have movement between ages 8 and 20, you know, on, you know, slow introductions to the complexity of the adult world and adult faith.
So Adam and I, we had a conversation, you know, before we ever got to this point where we're doing the podcast, and we were talking about some interactions we had with our children. I mean, somehow this question has turned into solely about children, but we were talking about how, you know, something maybe was said at church and we he had to say, oh, you know, we know that people at church say this, but we don't, in our house, we're not really on board with this. But it does sort of, I feel like for them, at some point, they're going to be like, you know, Dad, then what are we doing here? You know?
I do that, but I also try and celebrate all of the great things too. So that, you know, you're that time that you come home and you say to your kids, hey, you know, we kind of try and add a little bit of humor to it. That talk really was off the rails there. And this is why we don't agree with that, blah, blah, blah. But you've created a foundation of admiration generally for the people there. So I don't know. I really hope that at least, you know, the way I'm strategizing it with my own kids, that they say, oh, well, we're there because of A, B, and C, but we also have the opportunity to balance, you know, the demand for obedience with our own personal revelation and our own flexibility. And I think that if you have, you know, as Dan said, it's not something that I personally would advocate doing really young. I don't make these things super complicated for my kids, but I think if you do have those conversations, hopefully, I feel like it was done with me. The kids are raised to understand the nuances of a community, right? And not look for the community to sort of answer all their needs, you know? And I hope that as Dan said, having those honest conversations, both really positive and sometimes often pointing out the variations in what you believe versus what's being taught at church will help create a flexible child.
Yeah, because we want to protect them from the pain that we feel sometimes in our faith crisis/transition, and you know it's no fun to reorient your worldview, you know, kind of thing, and it's no fun to feel like you're out of step with everybody around you, even though I promise you you're not out of step with everybody around you. There's lots of people in various stages of this journey that you could really find some common ground with, but. We want to protect them from the pain, but we don't want to protect them and put them in such a bubble that, like the parents that never expose their kids to other children for fear of bacteria, you know, they're less healthy, you know, because they haven't developed the antibodies, they haven't developed the skills of what it means to disagree and still love each other, you know. The parents who never fight in front of their children and still show that, look, we can totally disagree, and yet there's our love for each other is not in doubt here, kids. You know, those are the kinds of things. Yeah.
I had a seminary teacher who exemplified this so perfectly. My seminary teacher was this sort of middle-aged single woman in Manhattan who actually had attended Hebrew University and spoke Hebrew and was of Jewish heritage. And she, I know this sounds crazy, but she actually took several of us to Israel the summer after 10th grade. But she wouldn't step foot in the Jerusalem Center. And she felt like the Jerusalem Center was just indicative of everything that's wrong with the church. But the woman had the strongest testimony of Jesus Christ of anybody I've ever known. And so there was this kind of like, there's this example of somebody who's just like, you know, bearing testimony every morning that Jesus is the Christ and this is the restored gospel. And yet there's this horrible building in Israel that the church, you know, the institution that we belong to, seemed to think at some point was a good idea. And when we went to Israel, she wouldn't let us step in it because she just felt like it was kind of an adulteration of you know, the pure culture that she was trying to get us. And she took us to synagogues and it was this really like, I think for me, what I'm trying to describe, which is, you know, this love for doctrinal truths and this goodness, and she recognized the goodness of the people in our local congregation, but there were just these things that she was very vocal about saying, this is wrong. I hope that maybe I could be doing that with my kids.
Yeah, I think it was probably just in the last 3 months or so I did the podcast where I told this one story. I'll just tell it very briefly. My wife and I were very worried about when our daughter was about 16, that they'd kind of change out the young women's presidency. And we'd kind of seen the woman who was called as a president as sort of a, you know, a pretty staunch, uber, you know, you know, in other words, she wasn't our style of Mormon, you know, let's put it that way, kind of thing. And we're just thinking, oh, and then of course she picked counselors that were sort of in the same, you know, leanings with her. And we're just thinking, what is our daughter going to meet every week? And after, you know, a couple of months of them being with the presidency, we just decided to talk with our daughter, Hope. And we kind of said, now, how's it going? Are you enjoying Young Women's? What kind of stuff do you talk about? And she just did this. And then we just kind of got around to it. We said, well, you know, not everybody kind of, you know, when they're talking about the gospel, everyone kind of has their own personality and their own style, and they emphasize this, that, and, you know, this things and stuff. And you know that you don't have to believe everything that's being said by, you know, such and such, and think that theirs is the only way or the one true way. And she just, it was just the greatest, you know, teenage moment. Duh, I live with you guys.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was just her answer. And we just were so relieved that, you know, she had gotten a sense of different people with different personalities and styles. And there's, you know, she had begun that process of weighing it. Yeah, that's my mom's take. That's my dad's take. So in the end, I'm glad for this. I think she's a healthier person. She's a healthier adult because of having, you know, lived in our home for all these years and in her quiet way observing things and recognizing different personalities and styles and all that stuff. I just think she's, you know, not only within the church is she a healthier person, she's just as she's 20 years old now, she's a healthier adult. And I'm just grateful for it. So this whole business of protecting us, protecting our kids from pain, I honor where it comes from, but a little pain's good. I think a little bit of cognitive dissonance and some wrestling is healthy. You know, Viktor Frankl once said, well, it's not once, his famous book is Man's Search for Meaning. He basically, you know, argues that there's a different kind of peace than, you know, George Costanza's Serenity Now, you know, where you're without tension. He talked about peace not being a tensionless state, but it's rather being a state in which you have found something that's worthy of your endeavor, that's worthy of the human spirit, I think is his language. And so once you've found that, you live life in somewhat of a grounded, peaceful state, even though you're going to be fighting and wrestling and people aren't going to agree with you always. And you're not going to have a conflict-free life. You're not going to be able to have freedom from conflict. But you're going to know that any conflict and any wrestle that you're doing is in service of something good and important. And, of course, now I've chosen, and you guys are in the midst of choosing, whether Mormonism is worth being in that level of tension over. You know, I think it is. We can talk a little bit more about reasons for that later. But at least with my daughter at this point in my life, as I've watched her, you know, as close as any parent really can, you know, grow from this 16-year-old to this 20-year-old, almost 21 right now, she just seems like Mormonism with a more complex view than probably the average kid. She's just living the gospel in a way that I would want any child to live the gospel. You know, good sense about her, you know, judging for herself, pretty much certainly buying into the gist. She hasn't begun a lot of deconstruction process yet, but I know that she knows that I'm there for when and if questions come, and that it's safe. And so I really think that in some ways, all this stuff that I know we sometimes want to protect ourselves from is actually really a blessing.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.